stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Wednesday afternoon. Delighted to have you with us. This program, if you are new to EWTN, and I know that every Advent, every Lent, we get new listeners, people who don't know anything about, maybe they don't know anything about the Catholic faith, and they certainly don't know anything about Advent or Lent, and they've got questions about the Catholic faith. Why does the Catholic faith teach such and such about purgatory, or about Mary, or about indulgences? Why do we teach these things? Well, we can answer those questions for you on this program. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email if you'd rather do that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com. All right, Pedro Quiles, our producer, Michael McCall handling the phones today. Give him a shout out. He'll be the first voice you hear when you call that number. Also, Vanessa Sanchez handling social media for us. She's keeping an eye on YouTube and Facebook. So if you want to ask a question there, put it in the chat screen. Vanessa will pass that on to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well, trying to stay peaceful during Advent. Are you doing the same thing?
I, as much as can be expected.
You got a granddaughter with a fever. It's not easy to be peaceful during
that's
that.
Exactly right, yeah.
So, but hang in there. Hope that she will as well. We're going to lead off with this question from Ron. This is one of those that pops up every so often. What is the current position of the Catholic Church on limbo?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. Limbo is a theological opinion. It is not a dogma of the Church, never has been.
Okay.
A dogma is something that all Catholics are bound to believe because the Church has declared that it is a doctrine that is taught by divine revelation.
Okay.
And that the Church makes no such position regarding limbo. The doctrine of limbo emerged as a theoretical response to a conundrum, namely, what happens to the souls of infants that die without baptism, given that they would have been conceived with original sin, and dying without baptism, they would not have sanctifying grace. So you know, the reward of heaven is not something that we naturally deserve. It's something that's graced to us mm-hmm. through the gift of sanctifying grace, whereby we are supernaturally enabled to merit something that we wouldn't naturally merit. I mean, even a person who was without sin wouldn't deserve an eternity of bliss in consequence. Maybe they'd get, 10,000 years in a Caribbean hotel or something, but they wouldn't intrinsically deserve the vision of God. It would take divine levels of merit to merit that kind of divine reward. And in fact, that's exactly what the Church says, that it's through this sharing of God's own nature that we call sanctifying grace, that reward of heaven is given to us. So if they don't have sanctifying grace in baptism, what happens to them? Well, it seems absurd to consign souls that have never committed personal sin to perdition. And Catholics thought, no, that can't possibly happen. So to solve that theological conundrum, the hypothesis got floated, well, maybe there's an intermediate state. It's not damnation, but it can't be the beatific vision. It is, in fact, the Caribbean hotel, as it were, of the afterlife, a place of natural happiness, but not the beatific vision. And that made enough sense to people that it caught on and became quite popular for a long time, but was never proclaimed a dogma. Now, the current predilection of the Church, including recent popes, has been to presume that God likely grants the gift of sanctifying grace to infants that die without baptism in some means known only to Him. And that seems more consonant with the divine mercy.
All right. Ron, thanks so much for your email. Here's one that seems a bit vague. Maybe you can figure out where she's actually going with this. This is from Emily. Emily says, how did Jesus address the 5,000? I'm not quite sure what she means by that.
How did he address the 5,000? Meaning, like, how did he speak to them? You know, that is a good question. And I don't think we know, right? I don't think we know, other than that he fed them. You know, I don't know that we know what he said on the occasion.
Okay. Sorry, Emily, that's where we have to leave that. Here's one from Jonah. Is it true that the particles left by the Eucharist are no longer important? Interesting use of the word.
That is not true.
Okay.
The particles of the Eucharist are important, which is why the Church takes such great care in its handling of said particles. So you'll note, for example, that as the priest is purifying the elements after the distribution of Holy Communion, he makes sure to consume even microscopic particles that he couldn't otherwise see. I mean, he washes out the chalice and drinks from it, washes out the ciborium and so forth.
Yeah.
And then there's very, very strict rules about how you handle the purification of the elements in the sacristy after Mass even, and even down to the level of the type of drainage system that's used.
That's right.
So if there were a particle that somebody missed, it's not going to go into the public sewage system, for example.
Okay. Very good. And Jonah, thanks so much for your question. Glad we could clear that up. This one from Leroy. Is it appropriate to pray, Sweet and Immaculate Heart of Mary, be the salvation of my soul?
Okay, thanks. Appreciate the question. So Marian prayers and devotions are not theologically precise dogmatic statements. They have more of the character of poetry, and they are allowed to be embellished through it's kind of hyperinflation.
Okay.
Right? In the way that you would say if you're writing love poetry, right?
Sure.
You're gonna say things in love poetry that are not literally true. You know, what's that song? You're the only woman in the world.
Oh, yeah.
To me. Well, I hope not. Right? Not literally, but figuratively, sure.
Sure.
Right? Sure. And in the same way, it's not literally true that Christ, that Mary is the salvation of my soul, but it could be said in a poetic way that would be consonant with Catholic dogma.
Yeah, Leroy, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Dylan in El Centro, California. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We have a couple lines open. You can grab one right now. A couple of great books to talk about from EWTN Publishing. One of them is The Spiritual Legacy of Archbishop Fulton Sheen. You'll encounter gripping stories of Archbishop Fulton Sheen's uncanny ability to read hearts, win back the wandering, and draw even non-Catholics to Christ, sometimes through a single conversion. Through the wisdom and witness of Venerable Fulton Sheen, you'll discover practical ways to grow in holiness and strengthen your walk with Christ. It is written by our friend Father Charles Connor. It's a great book, available right now from EWTNRC.com. And got another great book, Pope Leo XIV, The Election of a Pope in Pictures. Now, this is a beautiful picture book. I've seen it. We've got it here in the studio. It's a commemorative volume with powerful photographs, profound reflections on each step of this historic moment from this very calendar year, from the 9 days of mourning for Pope Francis through the hidden duties of the College of Cardinals to the white smoke that signaled the new dawn for Christ Church and the welcoming of a new pope, Pope Leo XIV, The Election of a Pope in Pictures, also The Spiritual Legacy of Archbishop Fulton Sheen, both available from EWTNRC.com. Do check that out. Would make a great Christmas gift for somebody on your list.
You know, I always try to be honest with the listeners, and when I make a mistake, I like to correct myself.
All right.
So I actually conflated two different songs, Air Supply's Every Woman in the World and Ambrosia's Only Woman.
Okay.
Two different songs. It's actually You're Every Woman in the World to Me.
Okay, so
which I should have
kind of bridging the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Which would be an equally bizarre thing to take literally.
Makes me dizzy.
Yeah, no doubt.
If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Dylan in El Centro, California, listening on our great partner there, JP2 Radio. Hey, Dylan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, guys? A couple bullet points. I was always under the assumption that Protestants were protesting the Catholic Church. So, and I could be wrong on all of this. I was having a discussion with someone, and it sparked it by starting with, he said that non-denominationals were not Protestant. And I, you know, thought, okay, please explain that to me. And then he went on to mention, you know, that there was 7 original or something like that. And then I've heard you say that there's 50,000 different types. So I ended with, you know, anyone that was a follower of Christ that wasn't Catholic, from my understanding, that would be considered Protestant. And then he began to go into, okay, what about the Eastern Rite? And I was like, well, they're Catholic. And I could be completely wrong. But,
I can set you straight. I got this. I'm with you 100%. Thank you very much for the question. And, you know, I had to go get a PhD in church history to get all this straight in my head.
Like, sure.
You know, for the average person on the street who goes up in their non-denominational or denominational church, right, that's ground zero for them, whatever their natal tradition is. And then they're kind of vaguely aware of people outside of it, like not always clear about how it all shakes out. I mean, actually, it wasn't when I got to college. I took a theology class at Wheaton College, where one of the assignments for the course was to write the history of the denomination that you grew up in.
Oh, gee.
And so I think I was 19, 20 years old before I ever dove deeply into the history of my own denomination, which was the Presbyterian Church in America. Right.
Wow.
So that's quite normal, right? So from the Catholic point of view, Christ founded the Catholic Church in his lifetime during his public ministry and sent the apostles into the four corners of the world to preach the gospel and to make disciples, which they did. And so Christianity spread across the world. And the bishops of the Catholic Church, in communion with one another, and the Bishop of Rome, constituted the Catholic Church. But from an early age, there were, of course, those who broke away from Catholic unity and formed bodies apart. I won't bother to name the ones from antiquity because there's really no historic continuity with any group today from those earlier dissenters. But the biggest split that took place in Christendom that's still very much with us is the split between East and West that began in the 11th century and really culminated in the 13th. And that's the division between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches. Eastern Orthodox churches are not the same thing as Eastern Rite Catholic churches, all right? The Eastern Rite Catholic churches and the Eastern Orthodox churches have the same geographic, liturgical, theological patrimony, but Eastern Rite Catholic churches are still in communion with the Pope. Eastern Orthodox churches are not. Okay, so that's the big division. Then in the 16th century, second big division that's still with us today was when the Augustinian monk Martin Luther began his protest against Catholic practice, dogma, hierarchy, and law. And sparked what's known as the Protestant Reformation. Now, Luther did not really begin the idea of reforming the church. Reforming the church was a Catholic idea that dates, well, at least to the mid-12th century. And so there were reforming groups and reforming orders and reforming thinkers, but Luther was willing to take that call for reform in more radical directions and to explicitly repudiate the authority of the Pope and of councils and of sacred tradition and to proclaim the principle of the Bible alone being his sole rule of faith. Luther believed that when he proclaimed the Bible alone as the sole rule of faith, that others would flock to his movement, and the Reformation that he was starting would essentially reform Catholicism. He didn't have a conception of himself as starting a new movement. He wanted to reform what he thought of as the one holy Catholic and apostolic church to which he assumed he belonged. But he got himself excommunicated in 1520 by Pope Leo X, and so he did in fact end up starting a new movement. Now, contemporaneous with Luther, there was another fellow in Zurich, Switzerland named Ulrich Zwingli, who claims to have come to his reforming ideas independently of Luther, but that seems to be a bit of a stretch. He probably had reforming ideas, but he did borrow some ideas from Luther. And he initiated what's called the Reformed tradition in Switzerland that has some points of difference with Luther. And the differences were severe enough in Luther's mind that Luther would not make common cause with the Zwinglians. He considered them outside the faith and outside of redemption. There were some people in Luther's own hometown in Germany that had ideas even more radical than those of Zwingli, and Luther considered those just completely beyond the pale. And so there was diversity in Protestantism, and that's what were called Protestants, these early groups that broke away after the Reformation of Martin Luther. Diversity even from the very beginning. A generation later, John Calvin in Geneva consolidated the Reform movement in Switzerland and also in France. And in the late 1520s, King Henry VIII removed his obedience from the Bishop of Rome and established himself as head of the English Church, and thus began the Anglican or English Reformation. So those are kind of the main outlines of how that thing shook out. When we talk about historic Protestantism, we generally have in mind the churches that can trace their origins to the Reformations of Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, and Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then sometimes people will talk about a fourth group called the Radical Reformation or the Anabaptist Reformation. Those were dissenting groups in the 16th century that typically did not fit into those other three categories. And the one thing they would typically have in common was the rejection of infant baptism. And so those are the sort of historic groups. Now permutations and divisions have continued in the non-Catholic world ever since, most of which with some kind of historic connection to those early 16th century Protestants. And so, you know, loosely speaking, we would consider Protestant Christians who have either some sort of direct or indirect continuity with the doctrine or practice that was articulated by Luther and Calvin and the earliest reformers, okay?
Okay.
The other major group, of course, would be the Eastern Orthodox, which do actually have historic continuity with antiquity. And that sort of settles it. Now, some historians and analysts like to consider modern Pentecostalism, which, you know, really begins in the heart of the Protestant tradition in around 1900, but has grown to be a movement of such vibrancy and power that you really can, and with some significant doctrinal deviations from historic Protestantism, that some historians think we should set Pentecostalism aside is, say, a fourth big movement in contemporary Christianity, even though they have a huge affinity with traditional Protestant doctrine.
Okay. Dylan, is that helpful for you?
You know, I'm hoping that I can just find it and present him this whole clip because I forgot to ask you to dumb it down for me. I'll have my wife listen to this and explain it to
now,
me.
Now, one question you did ask that I didn't answer is to whether or not we should consider non-denominational Christians Protestants. Generally, that's the way historians would in fact make that association. The way the Catholic Church does it, particularly the Second Vatican Council, is it distinguishes those who have received Trinitarian baptism that are not Catholic.
Yeah.
Right? They are either Catholic, they belong to one of the historic apostolic churches like the Orthodox Church, or they don't. Right? And if they don't, then that's pretty much what we would lump in as Protestant. The Second Vatican Council says all of these people, in virtue of their Trinitarian baptism, should be granted the dignity of being called Christians, that they are in some measure in union with Christ and the church that he founded through that one common baptism.
Okay. Dylan, good news for you. Our producer, Pedro, will have this program posted. You can pull it up on EWTN's Podcast Central in about 2 hours or so. It takes a little processing time for the internet to handle all that. So go to EWTN.com/podcasts, and we have all those in alphabetical order, so you'll be able to find this program called A Communion with Dr. David Anders. Dylan, thanks so much for your phone call. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is called A Communion here on EWTN. Mary in Omaha could not hang on with us, but she wanted to know, is it okay to read Pema Chodron if I am Catholic?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So that is, that's a prudential call, and I'll explain what I mean. So I personally am a believing, faithful Catholic, and I want to be faithful to the Catechism of the Catholic Church and the dogmas of the faith, and I know what those are.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty well educated in what those are. And I'm also a professional student of world religions. I have a PhD in religious studies. And so I have studied world religions, not only Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I have a professional interest in those topics. And I study ancient religions well, you know, Greek and Roman paganism, the philosophical traditions, and so forth. Personally, because of my background, if I read Pema Chodron, I'm not in danger of becoming a Tibetan Buddhist, right? I do think that this is just my statement of myself, that I have a pretty well-developed sense of how world religions shake out, how I have categories that I've worked out as a believing Catholic for how I should evaluate them, and I'm able to read elements of the wisdom traditions around the world and separate what I would consider to be the wheat from the chaff. And the wheat would be things like, you know, when Aristotle, the pagan philosopher, writes a philosophical treatise on ethics, the Nicomachean Ethics, it falls short of the dignity of Christian ethics. Aristotle, for example, doesn't really have a category in there for charity. Love is not a virtue in his mind. He doesn't despise love. It's just not there. It's just not part of his system, right? He particularly love oriented towards, say, the least of these among us, you know, the poor and the lime and the blamed and the outcast. That's not Aristotle's view of the universe. He has much more typically Greek civil virtues in mind, right? Now, given that caveat, I can look at Aristotle and say, this guy really thought and reasoned quite well about the virtues in the moral life, and yet he didn't have the insight that he would have had he been privy to the incarnation of Christ and our Lord's teachings, right? Which is why later Catholic philosophers have no hesitation to pick up Aristotle and, as it were, baptize him, filling out what's lacking with regards to the incarnation and the doctrine of charity, right? So they'll make use of him, but they'll also criticize him. In the same way, I can read Buddhist literature. I think the Dhammapada, for example, is a magnificent piece of wisdom literature. And I can say, okay, these guys have some good insight into human psychology and morality and that sort of thing. And they have some decent criticisms of, say, paganism and idolatry. But I'm not going to go with them when they start talking about, Buddhist cosmology and karma and rebirth and all these metaphysical doctrines that are no part of the Christian tradition and that I think cannot be reasonably held. There's no good evidence for them, and, I'm going to draw the line there, right? And I can kind of separate those things out. Prima Chodron comes from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, again, which, like any tradition, you can read in some of that literature and you can say, okay, there are some, you know, as human beings, they can make observations about human experience that seem wise and helpful, and they have some insights into human ethical dilemma. But from a Catholic point of view, Tibetan Buddhism is also saturated with superstition. And there's a lot in it that a Catholic could not hold, more in Tibetan Buddhism than you would find, say, in Theravada Buddhism. I mean, it's just more metaphysically complex, more hierarchies of beings, demonic spirits, and these sorts of things floating around in Tibetan Buddhism. So I think the level of discretion that a believing Catholic would have to bring to the analysis of Tibetan Buddhism would be significantly heightened, and there are a lot of pitfalls to be avoided. So before I told anyone, yeah, you should go read this or that book, the first thing is one would have to, know their own Catholic faith extremely well.
Yeah.
Have a really good critical discernment on how to separate the wheat from the chaff. And then most importantly, why? Why are you reading this? Like, for me as a historian, I would read that kind of literature for critical historical interest or maybe to inform my radio show. But I'm not going to naively take that kind of literature as a pattern to guide me in my Christian living.
Great answer. And Mary in Omaha, thanks for your question. We'll be right back. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. Tell us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Always fascinating to find that out. 833-288-EWTN. 888-3986, or if you've got a question about the Catholic faith for Dr. David Anders. Here now, Gary, a first-time caller from Toledo, listening on the great Annunciation Radio. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I'd like your opinion on Blessed John Duns Scotus, the Franciscan theologian
yep.
who believed that the Word of God would have been incarnate in Christ even if the first man and woman had never sinned.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So this, of course, is Scotus's theological opinion. It's an allowable theological opinion, and it runs contrary to St. Thomas's theological opinion. Thomas Aquinas's position was, when he asked this question, would the Son of God have become incarnate had Adam not sinned? Thomas's answer is, we are given no explanation in Scripture for the incarnation of the Son other than the redemption of the human race. So if the human race didn't need redeeming, we have no positive revelation to suggest to us that there would have been some other rationale for the incarnation. Now, Scotus has a different way of thinking. Scotus likes to reason from what he thinks is fitting. And so not just this is what God revealed, but man, wouldn't this be a neat thing if God had done it? That seems to be the sort of thing God would do, right,
all
given
right.
God's character. And his argument is basically that the good of the incarnation is so great that above and beyond the fact of the redemption, mm-hmm. that it's an end worth God having aimed for. Right now, there's another aspect of Scotus's theology, and this is speculative on my part. So this is not something that I remember reading in Scotus, but it's something I'm speculating about Scotus from what I know about him.
Okay,
Scotus was really the first major theological voluntarist in the late medieval tradition. And what I mean by a voluntarist is someone for whom the question of will, voluntas in Latin, becomes a determining idea. And with the rediscovery of Averroes, the Muslim philosopher who was deterministic in his thinking, the Orthodox Franciscan school of late medieval scholasticism pushed back against Arabic necessitarianism by heavily stressing the freedom both of God and of humans. And so there is one interpretation of Scotus's anthropology, for example, in which humans have a kind of radical, libertarian, indeterminate free will that is conditioned by nothing. And it's a very radical view of human freedom. Thomas
wow.
Williams, the noted modern Scotus scholar, takes that point of view. And the emphasis on divine freedom in Scotus will eventually lead his pupil, William of Ockham, into nominalism for reasons that I'll make clear in just a moment. If you take that position, that God's will is radically free and constrained by nothing, and then you imagine that the fact of human sin is sort of the necessary precondition for the incarnation, one could, and again, this is speculative on my part, possibly arrive at the thought, Adam has compelled the hand of God, right? You know, God in his mercy is sort of forced by Adam's sin to decree the incarnation. If the incarnation is sort of locked in a chain of causal reasoning whereby it can only occur under this set of conditions, a radical voluntarist doesn't like that sort of thing. He doesn't want the divine will to be constrained in that way. So Ockham, not Scotus, will later say things like, you know, Christ could have become incarnate in an ass had he wanted to, rather than a human being. Like, there's, even though to us that seems like something that would be grossly unfitting, Ockham's argument was, well, God doesn't have to respond to your sense of what is fitting. Right, he's free of that. There are no sort of absolute formal categories that constrain divine willing, which is why Ockham eventually opts for nominalism in his epistemology, right? Because he doesn't want there to be natures that would constrain, say, the divine law. Luther, who called himself a student of Ockham and Ockham his master, definitely applies that line of reasoning, not just hypothetically, but in fact, he believes that is what God does, that God actually acts in ways that are to us patently absurd and unjust, in particular, the double predestination of the saints and the damned, right? And Luther recognizes that that seems to frustrate all of our basic moral intuitions about equity and fairness, and his answer is, God doesn't have to answer to your basic intuitions of equity and fairness, right? So the whole dynamism of divine freedom and versus compulsion or necessitarianism sort of runs in the background of that whole stream of theology, and might also be a factor in why Scotus wanted to separate the incarnation from some sort of necessary chain of causal reasoning connected to human sin. What do I think about it? Well, first of all, I think this is wildly speculative stuff. And Thomas Aquinas himself says, when talking about the will of God, you know, you can, if when giving explanations that relate to God, you can say, because God willed it. But when you get to the question, why did God will it? No answer can be given, right? That doesn't mean that God acts arbitrarily. It means that that's where our chain of causal reasoning has to stop. That's where the explanatory buck stops from the point of view of our limited place, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, this is what would God have done under different circumstances is a question that is almost pointless to ask, right? My favorite series of children's books that I'm always quoting, Chronicles of Narnia, the stand-in for Jesus Christ in the series, of course, is the lion Aslan.
Yeah.
And the human characters in the story who make mistakes, and Aslan comes and corrects them, are always asking Aslan, what would have happened had I not done this? And Aslan always answers, haven't I told you? No one has ever told what would have happened. But I can tell you very well what will happen if you do what I'm saying now, you know?
Yeah.
No one has ever told what would have happened. My own personal, and this is, again, this is something that Catholics are not bound by authority to hold. I mean, you can take Scotus's position. It's an allowable opinion in Catholic theology. My preferences are with Thomas and with the Neoplatonic roots of Thomistic metaphysics, right? So I am not bothered by the idea that God be compelled by some necessity of his own nature, right? And that's not a troublesome idea to me. In fact, I find the idea of a divine intellect that's sort of conceivable apart from the divine will, and a divine will that runs flat counter to human intuitions about what's good or just, to be deeply problematic for many reasons.
Appreciate your call, Gary. Thanks for checking in from Toledo. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Time for a few more calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Anthony is listening to us in New Jersey, actually watching us on YouTube. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Hi, guys. Love your show. Dr. Anders, I recently got knowing that the difference between Orthodox and Catholic, the particular doctrine of the Filioque. Can you explain a little bit more of the detail about what that difference is? Because I'm having a hard time kind of like comprehending
thanks.
The Catholic
so,
view.
So the Filioque emerges in discussions about the nature of the Blessed Trinity. And as you probably know, the Christian tradition is unique in holding that not only is God one in nature, but that God is threefold in persons. And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, a nature answers to the question, what? What is that thing, right? I have a colleague, Tom Price, sitting across from me at the desk here. If I point at Tom and I go, what is that? The proper answer is that's a human being, all right? Person answers to the question, who? Who is that? Well, that's Tom Price. Now, in normal experience, in our experience, when you have one what, you have one who. One human being, one person. And we know what that looks like because we're very familiar with it. The Christian position is that in God, you have one what and three who's. Anders, how can I have one what and three who's? I don't know. But you have one what and three who's. Okay, the who's are Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, they differ from one another only in one way, and that is relation. The Father differs from the Son in being the Father, so he relates to the Son by way of paternity. The Son relates to the Father by way of filiation. The Spirit relates to the Father and Son by way of spiration, which is a fancy word that means the way the Spirit relates to the Father and the Son. Okay. Now, there is also a concept in Trinitarian theology that the Father is the principle or the source. And by principle, we mean literally that from which things proceed.
Okay.
And so in the manner of, say, a geometric proof, you have axioms, and then you have the steps of the proof that proceed from the axioms. Now, they don't proceed temporally. They don't proceed in time. Take the elements of the Pythagorean theorem, for example. I mean, you can find a relationship, a sort of hierarchy in geometry between the axioms and the conclusions that you could arrive at to prove the Pythagorean theorem. But the conclusions don't become true at a point in time separate from the axioms. They're all eternally true. It's an eternal relation.
Okay.
And so procession here isn't referencing a temporal relationship. And that's how you have to understand it in God. So the Father is the source. He's the principle from which Son and Spirit proceed, but it's an eternal procession. This concept of the primacy of the Father in that sense is called the monarchy of the Father. And the dynamism of Christian faith is of being reconciled to God the Father through the Son. And so we as Christians enter into the relationship with the Son, who is God, fully God, shares the divine nature with the Father, but we share in Christ's filial relationship to the Father, right? So by being reconciled to Christ, we are now enabled to say, Abba Father, dear Daddy God, right? We're reconciled within the Trinitarian relations to have the perspective of the Son vis-a-vis the Father, right? And so that monarchy of the Father and the distinction of the persons enters into, it's not just a speculative doctrine that we throw out there to talk about and sound fancy, it actually conditions and shapes the form of Christian self-consciousness, the form of Christian worship, the meaning of redemption. All right, so it's not, it has spiritual purchase in our lives.
Okay.
It's not a philosophical conclusion that we throw out in a textbook. It's a confessional statement that colors our worship and our activity as Christians in the church. Okay, now the doctrine of the filioque is a particular claim about the manner in which the Spirit specifically proceeds from the Father. If the Father is the source, if the Father is the principle from which Son and Spirit proceed, and the Son proceeds by way of begetting, we say he's begotten but not created, not made, and the Spirit by way of spiration. The claim in the filioque is that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and from the Son. The Spirit from the Father and from the Son. If you have ever attended a Latin Mass and you have prayed the prayer called the Gloria, the Gloria predates the controversy over the filioque and actually has its origins in the Christian East. And there's a version of it in the great doxology of the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. But devotionally, the Gloria to me feels like, if I can use this word, a filioque-ish prayer, right? Because it glorifies God the Father, it glorifies God the Son,
yeah,
with the Holy Spirit.
Mm.
And so like the sort of the dynamism of the prayer,
yeah,
is directed to the glory of the Father and the Son through the Spirit. And it's not like the Spirit's subordinate, but it has to do with sort of the direction of our devotional activity.
Yeah.
And Father and Son are paired there in a way to which the Spirit seems to be, well, like, you know, the accessory that moves us to that knowledge of Father and Son, right? Very much involved in a Trinitarian relationship, and yet we don't say, you get my point, right?
Yep.
The doctrine emerges explicitly. You find in Christian antiquity, East and West, many statements from the Fathers that we receive the Spirit from the Father through the Son. That dynamism is constantly restated, right? There's a heresy called Arianism, which is the belief that the Son is a creature, that he's not fully God. It emerged in the 4th century, and it kept poking its ugly head up, including in Visigothic Spain in the 6th century. And there were local Catholic bishops and synods in 6th century Spain that added the phrase filioque, meaning and the Son, to the recitation of the Creed, where the Creed says the Spirit proceeds from the Father. They added the phrase, and the Son, to emphasize sort of the point I was making about the Gloria, that the Son is equally God with the Father and worthy of worship, and emphasizing that the Spirit took his origin from both persons was a way of shoring up the divinity of the Son in response to the Arian heresy. And in doing so, there are passages of Scripture where Jesus speaks explicitly about, the Spirit whom I will send to you from the Father, that sort of thing. I quote some of the fathers as well, the Eastern fathers and Western fathers. Now, it didn't really become a serious point of contention between East and West until the 9th century. And there was a patriarch of Constantinople named Photius, who for a variety of reasons got into political and ecclesiastical controversy with the Pope, with the West. And he enumerated several things that he didn't like about the Western Church. And one could be excused for believing that there was a somewhat cynical or self-serving motive, because he got into political squabble and it served his interests to put down the authority of the Pope. He begins listing things that he really doesn't like about the Western Church. Well, one of the things he lists is the Western Church's use of the filioque, right? Mm. But that did not lead to the split between the East and West. And in fact, in many attempts the real split doesn't really definitively emerge until the 13th century and the Fourth Crusade. But there was a sort of gradual pulling apart of East and West for a variety of reasons: political, social, cultural, theological, linguistic, etc. And when pressed to give theological justification for that split, it became the habit of the Eastern churches to point to the Latin church's use of the phrase filioque as something that that didn't have the history of the Nicene Creed behind it, given that the earliest version of the creed did not include those words, right? So that's kind of a brief rundown on the history of the controversy. It's worth noting, though, that Eastern Catholic Christians don't typically recite the filioque as they recite the creed. Mm. And Pope Leo, who recently prayed with the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew in Constantinople, recited the Nicene Creed in Greek without the filioque.
How about that? Well, there you go, Anthony. Hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your phone call today. Those of you who are on hold, and there's quite a few of you, I would urge you to, if you don't mind, just stay on the line, because coming up next on most of these EWTN stations, it'll be Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch Pacwa, and I'm sure Father Mitch will be glad to tackle any or all of these great questions. So do stay on if you can. Right now, though, let's go to Mike, a first-time caller in Peru, Illinois, listening on the great WSOG. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today, sir?
Good afternoon. Love the show, guys. I just had a question about a Catholic taking on the Orthodox devotion of the prayer rope with the Jesus prayer. And I just wanted to know Dr. Anders' thoughts on that, if he knows what that is.
Yeah, I do know what that is, and I appreciate it. So most Eastern Orthodox spiritual practices would be completely acceptable for a Catholic to take on. And in fact, Eastern Catholics, there's very little devotional daylight between the practice of Eastern Catholic Christians and Orthodox Christians, right? Because they share the same theological, liturgical, devotional patrimony, right? They differ on their union with the Pope. But in terms of their prayer practices and theology and that sort of thing, there's a lot of similarity between Eastern Catholics and Orthodox Catholics. And of course, Eastern Catholics, they don't typically pray the rosary. They don't typically use Latin Catholic devotions. They use the devotional patrimony of the East, right? So, any Trinitarian devotion, any devotion that presupposes the dogma of the Trinity and fidelity to the Church and, is not obviously crossing any heretical boundaries, would be acceptable. The thing about devotions is these are not mandated by the Church. These are really tools that the individual Catholic uses to help configure their life and their heart and their imagination to Christ. And my recommendation is you find the devotion that you are most engaged in, that most motivates you to pursue the life of virtue, right?
Yeah.
And if that's the Jesus prayer, then have at it. If that's the rosary, have at it. If that's something else, have at it. You find that prayer, that devotion that moves you to pursue virtue and imitation of Christ, and that's the one for you.
Appreciate your call, Mike. Let's go to Mary in Texas, first-time caller there, listening on the Great Guadalupe Network. Mary, what's on your mind today?
Hello. I am calling about my niece. she's just told me that she's pregnant. She's not a Catholic yet. She's in the RCIA, but me as a full Catholic, I just need more inspiration of what to tell her to keep the baby.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, there's the teaching of the church, of course, and then there is the best way to communicate that to your niece, right? So as far as the teaching of the church and of human reason goes, unborn babies are human beings. Human beings have an intrinsic right to life. Depriving them of life is a grave sin. It's a very terrible thing, and we ought not to do it. I mean, pain of risking our own souls. I mean, it's a gross injustice to take somebody's life. You know, I mean, that just because they're in the womb doesn't mean they're not human beings. So, I mean, the doctrine of the thing is quite evident. Okay, now the question is, what is the best way to get that to land with your niece? And that's a much thornier issue. Because my guess is, if she's an RCIA, she probably already knows the church's position on abortion. And I don't know what her motives are for considering an abortion. And so I hesitate to give concrete advice. But I just want to point out to you that for many people who are in extreme situations and under a lot of stress, just presenting them with an abstract moral truth is often not the most effective way, right? Much more important is coming alongside them and showing them that you really love and genuinely care about them, and that you hear what they have to say and what their concerns are. And then maybe from a position of deep love and vulnerability to offer some alternatives. So, you know, I mean, for example, if the niece thinks I don't have the financial means to care for this child, well, there are ways around that, right? And there are helps that can be obtained to deal with that. You know, I mean, so this is not your only option, sort of thing.
Right. Hope that's helpful for you, Mary. Thank you so much for your care and concern for your niece. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Jason now, a first-time caller from South Carolina, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey there. Thank you for taking my call. I haven't been listening to the show too long, but I really appreciate the resource that y'all are. And my question today primarily pertains to the theory of atonement, particularly as it pertains to imputation and infusion of grace. So
yep.
I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, PCA, and I never really dove into this topic a lot until like the last month or so, when I'm kind of discerning the Catholic faith. And the idea of Christ or humanity's sins being imputed on Christ, and that essentially being the the penultimate sacrifice for sins and the atonement for that, versus the Catholic way. And I don't want to confuse listeners, so I'll let you speak to the infusion part. But which way of looking at it, imputation versus the Catholic ideology, like which one? I should back up. Is the idea of imputation was it kind of conjured up primarily from the reformers?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to cut you off because we've only got about a minute left on the show. This is a great question, and I could literally talk about it for an hour, so I've got to pile a bunch in like 30 seconds. So the doctrine of the imputation of Christ's righteousness to the believer and the imputation of the believer's sin to Christ through the exchange of by faith alone, that uniquely Protestant doctrine, is an invention of Martin Luther and has no precedent in the tradition whatsoever at all for 1,500 years. That is the conclusion not just of Catholic historians, but of Protestant historians like Alistair McGrath in his two-volume work, Justitia Dei, The History of the Doctrine of Justification, confirms that Luther's interpretation of justification is a complete theological novelty. At the other end, if you want to look at Matthew J. Thomas's book, Paul's Works of the Law in Second Century Reception, it's a great analysis of how the very earliest Christians understood Paul's statement that we are not justified by works of the law. And let me tell you something, they did not mean what Luther meant by that phrase. Modern biblical scholarship, Protestant biblical scholarship, comes to the same conclusion, and I would point you to works by Christer Stendahl, James Dunn, and in particular N.T. Wright. You might look at Wright's book simply titled Justification. All of these men are Protestants. All of them think that Luther got Paul wrong on the doctrine of imputation. If you will look at Romans chapter 2, which is a text that most Reformed Protestants in the PCA are taught not to think as principal, but go back and read Romans chapter 2 with the question, maybe this is the key to the book of Romans. Paul tells us explicitly that we are not declared righteous because we hear the law, but because we obey it, and obedience made possible through faith, because those who have the Spirit have their hearts circumcised and thus are able to keep the righteous requirements of the law, right? So through the Holy Spirit, we are enabled to do what we couldn't do without grace, namely love God and love neighbor, and thereby merit Christ's response, well done, good and faithful servant. Last thought, every single passage about the last judgment in the New Testament says that we are saved or lost according to our works, not the imputation of Christ, a concept that is nowhere mentioned in the New Testament.
Jason, thanks so much for your call. Dr. David Anders, nice work.
Thanks, Tom.
Wow, pretty fantastic. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of Call to Communion. Until then, God bless.